Hi everyone, it's Ryan Hoover, your host at Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. In this episode, I'm in San Francisco at AngelList HQ, speaking with Laura Deming and Daniel Gross. Laura grew up in New Zealand and came to San Francisco when she was only 12 years old to join a lab studying aging. She was accepted into MIT at the age of 14, that's right, 14 years old, and left to start Longevity Fund, a venture capital firm investing in companies aimed to help us all live longer and healthier lives. Our other guest, Daniel, came to the Bay Area from Israel, accepted into Y Combinator in 2010 as the youngest founder to go through the program at that time. His startup, Q, was later acquired by Apple, which led him to a leadership position across a number of AI and machine learning teams in the company. He eventually left Apple to work at Y Combinator, and most recently launched Pioneer, a program to identify and support brilliant people around the world. On this show, we talk about Daniel and Laura's experiences as founders as they've traveled from overseas to Silicon Valley. We also talk about health, aging, and what it would mean if we could live forever. You'll also hear Laura and Daniel's advice to ambitious young founders who are looking to start something big. And of course, I asked Daniel and Laura what's on their home screen and products that they love. But first, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. We'd like to thank Airtable for making the show possible. I've been talking with a diverse mix of companies that use Airtable to build their business, including Ryan Delk, COO at Omni.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Tell me more about Omni.
We're building the future of how people will own and access things.
If you were to describe Airtable in a single word, what would you use?
I feel like superpowers. I really feel like every time we move something from a Google Sheet or an Excel file into Airtable, I truly feel like I have superpowers and I can learn more from the data, do more with it, share it more easily, collaborate with more people. It helps me unlock so much more value from what I'm working on, even though the actual data or whatever I'm looking at isn't any different. It's just the interface and the power of all the different things you can do, from like building a true relational database around stuff. You don't even feel like you're interacting with a database. And then you get, you know, an hour in and you realize, oh, I've been building a relational database for the last hour, but I've just felt like I was intuitively, you know, sort of using this app that helped me, you know, organize this information.
You can get $50 in free credit by visiting airtable.com/producthunt.
We're happy to have Intercom as a sponsor of the show, a tool we've used at Product Hunt since the beginning. Once upon a time, when Product Hunt first started, I would monitor our Intercom dashboard to see who was signing up and visiting the site in real time. It was super fun to see the diversity of people across the world joining every single day. As people signed up, I reached out one by one, introducing myself in hopes to create a memorable first impression. Intercom made this easy to do with its in-app messaging, and while this isn't the most scalable strategy, people responded very positively. It helped really create a memorable impression and helped build that early community. Today, we use Intercom at a much bigger scale, answering questions and reaching out to people for feedback as we're building and launching new features. So if you're building a community or really any product with users, you can do this too. Check out intercom.com. Hey everybody, this is Ryan. I'm here with Daniel and Laura at the AngelList office. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for having us over, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for coming. So let's jump in a little bit of what's your background. Let's start with you, Daniel. What is your background? What are you working on? Tell me your life story in 30 seconds.
Sure. My name is Daniel Gross. I'll try to speak very quickly then. I'm originally from Jerusalem, Israel, born and raised. I moved out to Silicon Valley almost by total happenstance when I was 18 years old because I applied and got into a program called Y Combinator. I started a company called Q, which got acquired by Apple. I ended up running a bunch of search and machine learning teams at Apple across the company, across iOS, macOS, Apple Watch, and a bunch of other platforms. And then left Apple after running a fairly large organization in 2017, worked at Y Combinator, the organization that originally funded me. And then in 2018, started this project called Pioneer, which we'll hopefully talk more about today. So that's a little bit about me.
Wow. Okay. I was kind of half joking when I said 30 seconds. That was impressive.
I think that was like 25.
Yeah.
I don't know. The audience will tell us.
That was pretty good. Laura, what's your background? What are you working on nowadays?
Sure. So I grew up in New Zealand, and when I was 12 years old, I sent an email that changed my life. I emailed somebody who works in San Francisco on longevity science, moved here, worked in her lab for 2 years, then went to MIT, and then after that moved back out here to invest more in entrepreneurs who are trying to push forward the field of longevity.
Nice. Nice. When was that that you moved over here to San Francisco?
That was when I was 12. So that was about 12 years ago now.
Wow. I moved here 8 years ago. And so I kind of came in when mobile was already kind of taking off back in 2010. When did you move to San Francisco, Daniel?
I originally moved to Palo Alto. I wanted to be very close to Y Combinator. I was told that San Francisco was a distraction and Palo Alto and Mountain View were blissfully boring. This is true, by the way. I originally moved there in very late 2009, December 2009. So I think like everyone else here at the table, I was there for kind of the rise of mobile. And I don't think I made it up to San Francisco for an entire year. I remember taking the Caltrain for the first time up to the city because I finally had a meeting where I could not convince the other party to come meet me down south. And I slowly edged my way back, you know, up to the city. And I will say, they were totally right. It's a distraction. There's a lot to do here that does not relate to like company building.
That was the best practice, I think. When we went through Y Combinator, of course, Paul and Sam and everyone said, for those that are moving to the city, stay nearby YC, stay out of the city because, you know, you're going to be spending that 3 months just working and working and working. And it's best, you know, just to avoid distraction. But also the weather's nicer. Weather is warmer down there.
Yeah.
So I ended up staying in San Francisco because I was not going to move, but did the commute for Tuesday dinners. And yeah, it's a nice place to visit. I'm glad I live here in the city, though. More fun.
Yep.
But let's talk about Pioneer a little bit. So this launched, has it been a month or so?
Less than a month, yeah.
Yeah. So it caught my eye, saw it on Product Hunt, of course, and there's a lot of conversation around it. And caught my eye personally because, one, of course, I'm at Product Hunt and within AngelList, we're very pro-entrepreneurship, want to give people more access and accessibility to, you know, start a career or start a company in the technology space. And Pioneer seems to be focusing purely on that at the earliest stages. But yeah, tell us more about what Pioneer is and how you're thinking about it.
Yeah, so the high-level goal is Pioneer is basically an experiment to try and find, you know, thousands, maybe one day even millions of people who will become the kind of next Albert Einstein's, Marie Curie's, and Elon Musk's that are scattered throughout the United States and importantly the world. And what we try to do is we try to find these people in a way that's never really been done before, where we almost turn the process of kind of filling out an application and applying for a grant into a video game. No one's really brought kind of the power of software to this problem of finding the lost Einsteins. And I think it's really important to bring software and kind of internet scale to this problem because I believe that, you know, for every Ryan Hoover and for every Elon Musk in the world, there are thousands more that never really become the fully realized version of themselves. And I'm very unsatisfied by things like, you know, the Pell Grant or the MacArthur Fellowship that seem to try to find these people through the same techniques that, you know, the Ivy League uses, where you have like five or six people reading thousands of applications. There's no way that that's going to find the kind of underrated gems out there in the world. And so what we've done is we've built a kind of a software platform for this where anyone can apply. And unlike kind of a static moment in time that these traditional application programs have where you submit one application, talk a little bit about yourself. The game of applying to Pioneer takes place over 30 days. It's kind of like an extended job interview. And what you try to do over the course of 30 days is get as many points as possible in what we call the Pioneer Tournament. And the way you get more points is by telling the community.
It's like Hunger Games, right? You put people in an island.
Well, the key difference between this
person standing.
Well, the key difference between this and anything like Hunger Games is there are multiple winners. So it's actually not, it's competitive in a very healthy way, not in kind of a winner takes all way. And the way that you kind of get more points in Pioneer, there are multiple factors, but the predominant one is the community votes together on what they consider to be the most interesting and impressive person, not just at one moment in time, but over a course of 30 days. You kind of submit status updates, almost like tweets, about the progress you're making on the work that you're doing. So for example, you could apply and say, I'm working on fundamental research in chemistry. And, you know, week one, I spoke to, you know, a bunch of professors or teachers about my work. Week two, I tried a bunch of experiments in the lab. Week three, you know, the experiments didn't work out. Here's what I'm doing. You don't have to necessarily grow revenue. You just have to demonstrate that you're making kind of extraordinary progress, that you're an extraordinarily productive person. And at the end of the 30 days, we take the folks at the top of the leaderboard and we give them small grants to support their work. But much more importantly, we put them together with other people that we're funding, other prospective pioneers.
And in person, or is this all remote at that point?
Great question. So we're going to do both. We're going to have a hybrid model where we're going to fly everyone out to Silicon Valley, put them all together, get them to form real relationships. But we're also building out what we call Pioneer Home, which is kind of a whole suite of software built to really connect people who are disparately spread throughout the world. What I'm trying to do, what we're all trying to do, is give the benefits of the Ivy League to millions of people, millions of lost Einsteins around the world. Because my belief is the benefit of the Ivy League is not the curriculum. I think Google's an awesome curriculum. The benefit of the Ivy League is the network and the branding, right? You're like, I went to Harvard, now everyone thinks you're awesome. And you meet other people at Harvard that propel you to be the better version of yourself. And so the main question for us is, can we build a digital Ivy League campus? That's truly what we're going after. And if we do our job right, 10 years from now, the next great set of innovators and physicists, researchers, and even musicians should all be pioneers.
So applications have been open now for, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks, I believe. What kind of, you mentioned musicians, artists, all these different types of roles and crafts. Is it predominantly technology, though, or are you kind of seeing a nice mixture of people applying and kind of contributing so far?
Honestly, the response from the internet has gone shockingly well. So as you mentioned, we've just been open for a few weeks. We've gotten thousands of applicants from almost 100 different countries working on a whole bevy of things. There are, you know, 16-year-olds working on research in physics. There are also, you know, 24-year-olds writing their first record. And there are also journalists doing, you know, trying to get funding for some investigative research they want to do. So it really spans the entire chasm. And I really think we tapped into a well of desire of, you know, potentially, I think one day, millions of people just knocking on the door of opportunity. And, you know, I think creativity and talent comes in many shapes and forms. You know, for some, it'll be like the Ramanujan in India, who's just obsessed with prime numbers and is going to make great discoveries in the world. And I think for others, it'll be much more like the Beatles, you know, who are going to write, you know, art and poetry that, you know, that shapes our future. And we, so far, we seem to be seeing all of them.
How'd you get involved, Laura?
So I think when I first heard the idea, it just really resonated because, you know, growing up in New Zealand, you don't really have a good sense for what the world is like on a broader scale. I think if you're a very talented individual, like a young girl in New Zealand, and you want to go be a scientist, like how on earth do you go do that? Like what university will take you? And I was insanely lucky in that, you know, I had a dad who was super excited about science and would just talk about it nonstop. And so I knew from a young age that this was something that was wonderful to work on. But I also, the first email I ever sent, I got a reply that same day inviting me to come work and sort of, you know, talk to that person in, at a university in California. And I think, I mean, how, what is the likelihood of that, right? Like there are 100 versions of me that sent that same email and never got a response. And so how many girls are out there who just, you know, never got the chance to kind of come and kind of explore science and grow in that way. And so I think one of the super exciting things about Pioneer is like, wow, you could literally like 100x the number of like excited young scientists doing real work at an early age. The other fascinating fact is one of the seminal papers of longevity science, a two-author Nature paper in the 1990s, was a 15-year-old girl working on a project that nobody else in the lab would work on. And so young people can do great work, but I think it's really underappreciated, the extent to which that's a real phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of relevant to this conversation a bit is the product and team is a distributed team. And we have teammates in Paris, Bulgaria, Belgium, all over the world, India. And if you look at the resumes of some of these people, you're of course not going to see the traditional like ex-Facebook or Harvard graduate. In fact, I don't know if Rado, for example, on our team, one of the most talented engineers I've worked with, I don't even know if he went to school and I don't really care. But I've seen, going back to your point about the directory, like I've seen and worked with him now over the years, and I can connect these dots to make lines of kind of how he has progressed as an individual, as a product person, as an engineer, and so on. And right now it's so hard to evaluate people based on a resume and based on like a data point. With Pioneer, how do you avoid gaming? Like if people are sort of self-reporting, if I understand correctly, how do you ensure that someone isn't self-reporting something that's false?
Look, every system that relies on crowdsourcing at the volume that we're going to operate at has to tolerate some level of fraud. This happens, you know, with credit cards every day. The question is, how do you keep the fraud to kind of a tolerable level? And this isn't our first rodeo. You know, I spent many years reading thousands of YC applications. And so I'm familiar with kind of the nature of the system. The good news is, you know, we're kind of centralized and in control of our platform, which affords us the ability to remove out any and tease out any bad actors. And I think this is going to be one of those situations where we're just going to, you know, if people seem to be defrauding us and not saying the truth, we'll take them out. Now, in time, we'll, of course, build very obvious, interesting things to kind of validate people's claims. For example, the ability to plug in your Google Analytics account. Are you really getting that many page views on your site? Are you really getting that much revenue on Stripe? So we could come up with different ways to kind of validate people's claims. And I think that we'll just remove bad actors in time like any other system does.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the same risk is true for any seed stage company typically. They self-report their own metrics. And at the seed stage where you're raising a small amount of money, rarely do investors even, you know, do much diligence on that. And also, to their credit, the metrics sometimes aren't the ones that you're evaluating your decision on. And a lot of times it's the people because the product changes. Maybe there is no product yet. You're still involved at Y Combinator though. Is that correct? Or how do you kind of split your time between that and Pioneer?
Yeah. So I used to be a full-time partner at YC. Given the fact that there's obviously now Pioneer's in existence, I kind of stepped down and I still run this thing called YCAI, which is a vertical of the program dedicated to funding machine learning companies. The idea there is to reduce the amount of kind of activation energy required to start a project in AI, to make it as easy as it is if you were a team at Google to start an AI project, but for a company, if that makes sense. But you know, that's literally an order of magnitude less than the responsibilities of a partner, which enables me to spend kind of the majority of my time on Pioneer.
So Laura, you are, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're trying to prevent us from dying. Not really, but you're
increase
working...
healthy number of years of human life.
Yes, yeah. Yes. That's a better description, I think.
Live, be forever young.
Yeah, forever young. Tell us about that. Like, it's such a fascinating world and area that I think a lot of listeners probably don't know much about in terms of the science and everything behind it. But yeah, what types of companies are you investing in and what's kind of the overall mission?
Yeah, well, I think maybe a better way to think about it is removing limitations that humans have or increasing. So, you know, one thing could be increasing cognitive performance would be an example of kind of human augmentation that we're super excited about. It's not just kind of, you know, Dookie's number decrepit years in hospital bed. But I think, you know, there are a couple of fascinating facts that really underlie the field. One is the fact that there are, you know, 46 mammals, if you look at, that have just an extremely broad range of longevity. So we, as humans, tend to think, you know, we're anthropocentric. You know, we experience mortality, therefore all animals experience mortality. Not true. Certain animals don't age. Some actually have increases in fertility over time and decreases in mortality. If you look across the animal range, there's a wide variety of phenotypes out there, and we don't see that. We focus on kind of the fact that humans have and always sort of in our mind will age. But I think our question is, can we use some of the things that the animal kingdom has identified to allow them to kind of live longer, healthier lives and kind of allow humans to kind of remove the boundaries that have traditionally constrained us? And so that's one thing.
What are some of the mammals, by the way, that live a long time? Or
I'm glad you asked. So tortoises are just killer. Like, tortoises are having like decreased mortality with age. They're just plugging away. You know, they're 100 years old. And in fact, we don't know how long tortoises live because we haven't observed kind of like their natural mortality rate exponentially increasing.
What kind of is it? 100 years, 200 years?
100 years so far, approximately, we've evaluated.
Interesting.
But we're still watching them. Like, we're just watching them age. Naked mole rats are another species where, you know, rats live a couple of years, but then naked mole rats, which are almost, you know, identical physiologically, live 30 years. What is the difference between these two organisms? They look exactly the same. They're the same size, have the same physiology. But why does one live, you know, like 15 times longer than the other? We actually don't know also how long naked mole rats live because we haven't observed mortality rate increase exponentially. They could live 100 years for all we know. And so there's just, you know, all this, I think, room to explore biologically that we kind of tend to forget about because, you know, we've never really observed it until the past 100 years, but that's really coming to fruition now.
That's fascinating. So what kind of companies have you invested in so far in that space?
So we've invested in a broad range of companies. You know, one of the first and foremost that I think we were most excited to put capital into was a company called Unity Biotechnology. So they're based off of science published in 2011 showing that, you know, a fraction of your cells, less than 1%, get what we call to be senescent. That means they get really, really old. They start secreting really bad factors. And if you just remove those cells in a mouse, the mice actually kind of reverse the phenotype of aging and appear quite young. And so what Unity's working on are compounds that selectively eliminate just those cells. And they're actually in patients now. So I think one of the wonderful things for us is of the five companies we invested in our first portfolio, you know, three are now in people.
Wow.
And kind of have created therapeutics that are relevant to human. And so we're just insanely excited to watch those therapies, you know, the first wave of them become tested and see kind of what the results are.
And Unity has filed to go public, right?
So Unity is now a public company.
Is a public company.
Wow. Exactly.
So like, just to be clear for the folks that are listening, like getting the seed of Unity and now watching it go public is kind of like calling Uber at the seed. Yeah. That's a big deal.
Wow.
Right. Yep.
And yeah, that's such a fascinating area. So some people are concerned about this space too, of course. Like if we can extend the longevity, let's say, I'm going to make up a number, 200 years. Let's say people live for 200 years. Of course, that's going to impact a lot of other things with regards to like, what is retirement? How do we economically support an older generation? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think one fascinating question is why is 65 years the correct amount? You know, sort of like we kind of assume that the amount of years that we live today is like somehow inherently like optimized, but really it's optimized for like the savannah and kind of like extremely different mortality conditions. And so, you know, I think our presumption definitely is not that, you know, perhaps we should live forever, but, you know, our presumption is that, you know, we should be able to choose when we die. That could be earlier or later than it currently is. But I think the point that everyone in the world, and we really care about access and affordability, should be able to choose how long they want to live based on their particular circumstances. That's something that we really care about.
If people then choose to live 200 years, let's say everyone has access to that, what things need to change in society? I know this is a big question because it could impact everything, real estate to the future of work and everything. But like, how do we address that kind of long term?
Well, I think it's a fascinating question because we've already seen huge changes in the past 100 years based on kind of mortality sort of change that had nothing to do with kind of inherent limitations, more on kind of decreases in sort of more virally or sort of bacterially induced phenotypes. And what you've seen is really interesting. If society's adapted to that by decreasing birth rates, you're actually seeing kind of in some cases developed countries not have enough kids.
Yeah, it's a major issue in some parts of Asia.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think it's really hard to predict. But I think very counterintuitive things start to happen when you change things in that large way. And we're interested to see what will occur in the future.
Yeah. Are you investing in anything with regards to putting technical machinery inside of humans? And there's different terms for that, but augmenting people to become more like cyborgs. How do you feel about that?
Well, actually, I think maybe tying back to pioneers, there's a fascinating phenomenon, which is that some of the most interesting kind of breakthroughs have come through from high schoolers and undergraduates working in teams in this program called iGEM to kind of, you know, sprint for 4 months on developing products or projects that will sort of use CS-like techniques to create new organisms and things like that. And so I think there's a lot of that happening. And I think a lot of it is, interestingly enough, coming from kind of the younger generation of people who are combining new fields together to kind of create solutions that be hard to imagine otherwise.
Yeah.
Starting a business is hard. Accepting money shouldn't be. That's why Product Hunt is built on Stripe. In the early days, before we had a real team or any funding, we spent way more time than anticipated trying to figure out how to collect payments from our customers. We cobbled together a bunch of different solutions, but the end result wasn't professional, our accounting was messy, and even worse, it was a terrible experience for our users. Then we switched to Stripe. Integration was easy, and we started collecting money from people around the world without janky redirects or a lot of friction. Today, we use Stripe to collect subscription revenue from makers and startups around the world using Ship. Their web dashboard makes it really easy for anyone on the team to create new SKUs or discounts for customers without writing a single line of code. Whether you're building a marketplace, a SaaS company, or a subscription product, Stripe makes it easier to get paid. They also make it easier to get started with Stripe Atlas. Founders all over the world can incorporate a new business, set up a bank account, and access everything they need to get running in just a few clicks. If you want to start a business and make money on the internet, check out stripe.com.
Stay tuned to the end of this podcast for my talk with Ashish Jain from GE Ventures and Avitas Systems, a startup using drones and AI to inspect industrial assets like oil refineries and power lines.
So Daniel, you have a choice. How old do you want to live? How old do you want to be before you die? If you could choose any number.
Well, I think it's a little bit less about how long do I want to live and a little bit more about I don't ever really want to feel old. And I don't think anyone wants to feel old. And so even if you gave me, you know, imagine God or whatever deity you believe in, Satoshi picked a number for me and he was out there. I would like to be able to continue living my life with the vitality of a 20-year-old until the very end, right? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone wants to be able to throw a football to their grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that's what's most exciting about Laura's work is it's not necessarily even an increasing lifespan. It's just always feeling like a 20-year-old. And I guess to that end, maybe an interesting question to Laura is if you do want to always kind of feel like a 20-year-old, what are things... So until you kind of figure out, you know, the ultimate answer, what are things we should be doing in our day-to-day lives today to kind of be better, think smarter, feel better all the time? What are some good hacks?
Yeah, so it's a question we definitely get a lot. And I always feel bad in that as a scientist, I kind of want to qualify every statement and make very kind of like specific claims. I would say generally one of the fascinating facts has been in longevity, the first ever pathways discovered related to diabetes and sugar consumption. And so people always say sugar is bad, but I think, you know, in the field of aging, you're like, wow, sugar is the worst. Like of all the things that you could avoid, probably sugar is number one. Protein's actually possibly less good than you might think. So if you, you know, give mice less protein, they live longer. But I think just
but
kind
I
of,
love rotisserie chicken.
Exactly. But I think maybe just generally kind of eating less, exercising, but avoiding sugar as the number one and just like, you know, it's extremely toxic even to worms. That's probably the one unexpectedly bad thing that we know
is
about.
Is it worse than alcohol and other things, cigarettes?
I think possibly in a way that's underappreciated. You know, it's sort of like alcohol and cigarettes are quite appreciated for their bad effects. Sugar is kind of something you give to kids en masse, which is a bit scary.
Interesting. Yeah. What about nootropics in that field? Are you seeing some interesting companies and advances in that world?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's fascinating things around cognitive enhancement that we're seeing. So, you know, some of the most exciting companies come through are talking about these things like synaptogenesis, where you're allowing neurons to kind of make new synapses. And maybe, you know, there's certain sort of already on market compounds that seem to do that a little bit. There's nothing that we can disclose yet, but we're seeing a lot of exciting activity there.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating space. And of course, there's a lot of snake oil and there's a lot of skepticism around it. But at some point, I feel like we have to know more about our brain and our body to enhance it in some way cognitively. Like we spend all this time and effort, like physically, you know, whether it's taking creatine, if you're like trying to bulk up or things like that. But we know very little about like what can we take for our mind outside of like maybe basic vitamins and eating well.
Yeah, Laura, is there any interesting work around kind of electrotherapy as a cognitive enhancer? That is to say, when people talk about cognitive enhancements, they think about drugs, nootropics, modafinil.
Right.
But what about like electrocuting your brain to kind of be smarter or be better?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of fascinating facts. Like, I think A16Z even invested in a company that is working on kind of sort of brain-related sort of electrical signals to allow athletes to kind of better cement techniques. So while they train, they have like certain sort of signals coming from this device that might help them cement certain actions. I think there's actually, you know, whole venture funds dedicated to investing in electroceuticals, and it's one of those underappreciated areas. There's also a company from MIT that's attempting to use visual stimuli to impact Alzheimer's. And, you know, most of the time when you're something like that, you're like, well, I guess that's a little bit of an odd thing, but it's sort of the head of the neuroscience institute there has spun out this company. And so there's just so much exciting activity in that space.
Because right. And I guess the simple example of this is some people do get seizures from watching sequences of images. So it's clear that something's going on and that some people are exploitable. And so you wonder, is it kind of just like software? Are there other exploits around, you know?
Yeah. That's the other challenge too, is people respond so differently to certain drugs or certain things.
Yeah.
And understanding, you know, what's right for you is a tough challenge, especially if you're someone in the science, the scientific field. You need a large sample of people, I would assume, for a lot of these different experiments to understand how it affects different people, right?
Well, it's really funny. I think for the longest time in science, we tried to make mice all the same so that when we did experiments on them, we could, you know, very easily tell between two groups. And then we realized, well, we made them all the same, but humans definitely aren't the same.
Yeah.
So now we have to go back and reverse some of that.
Oh, the irony. So let's talk about some of your favorite products. Like what is an app on your home screen that everyone should use, everyone needs to know about? Or is there a product you use every day that really betters your life?
Anki. Are we familiar with, are you familiar Anki? With Anki?
I am not.
A-N-K-I. It's a spaced repetition memorization app. I believe it costs $20. So what's going to happen is you're going to hear me talk about it now and you're going to go download it. And then you're going to stare at that $20 price tag and probably say no. I did that for about 2 years. And then I got over it and I downloaded the app and it's been a massive game changer. Have you ever read Harry Potter?
No, I haven't. Did you memorize it?
Basically.
No.
I'm glad you asked. No. But in Harry Potter, maybe some of the listeners have, Dumbledore, the headmaster of the school, he has this wonderful app, okay? He can take his wand and he literally pulls thoughts that he wants to remember out of his brain and he like drops it in a thing called a pensive. And he just like can go to the pensive anytime later and just get what he wants. It's magical. Anki is basically that. You just put in Anki whatever you want to remember, and just as long as you open the app, you'll remember it.
It sounds like a great app for students, because as a kid in school, the way that I would, you know, take a lot of tests was sometimes just memorization. And this is how a lot of, you know, schools unfortunately teach, you know, is just have you memorize stuff. And so I'd create like songs to remember certain things in like science class, which is ridiculous. But yeah, it sounds like a useful tool for that.
And by the way, I mean, it's a lot of religions use the same technique, in particular using intonation as a way to remember things, creating songs. It's good for that. It's also good. The weird way to use it is by reading. Michael Nielsen has actually done a lot of great work on this. You can check him out on Twitter. But basically, the idea is you take various paragraphs that you're reading in a book that you want to remember, convert them into questions, and then put them into Anki. That's a big one.
So is it just copying and pasting the information that you want to memorize, essentially?
You do have to rephrase it a little bit, and it works a little bit better if you put an effort to rephrase it. I mean, it takes 2 minutes to do. And it's, I think, much more effective than highlighting something on Kindle.
What about you, Laura?
You can go buy a nanopore sequencer online as a consumer without a lab for $1,000. And this piece of hardware arrives, and it's the size of your phone, and it's amazing. It's a sequencer, and you can sequence 100,000 continuous base pairs. And so I think you know, probably listeners of this podcast are very excited about the future technology. And I think if you're going to look back and think about like what would be the equivalent of ordering like, you know, a computer sort of board in like the 1980s, I guess, or like earlier, it would have been, I think, getting a sequencer and just understanding that the technology is coming, and the fact that I can do that as a consumer now today is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it is wild how much more accessible technology in general has become. You know, before it was not only did you need to like buy an expensive machine or have access to a desktop computer, but also the information, the internet now gives us access to basically anything. YouTube alone is just like filled with everything. And this tying it back to Pioneer, it's now there's certainly still a disconnect though with access and I think mentorship. Yeah, what is, let's fast forward three, 4 or 5 years. What does Pioneer look like? What's the ultimate win for you?
Well, I have a very clear grasp on the 10-year vision. The 10-year vision is that when you think of the Time 100 list, I want the largest fraction possible of people on that list to be pioneers. And I think it's very achievable. And I think the way to get there maybe 3-4 years from now is to find ourselves in a world where we've built a community, a tight-knit community, where people are willing to be vulnerable and intimate with each other online just because they're part of the same network, if that makes sense. Just because they're part of the same tribe. Because that means we'll have built something real, something where people feel like they're part of a movement. And that means that they'll help each other in ways that aren't immediately kind of gainful. In the same way that, you know, if you meet someone else that's an alumni of your university, you'll kind of feel like you relate to them.
Or Y Combinator.
Or Y Combinator's
done a great job of that in building community and creating a brand just like Stanford or Harvard.
I think that's right. And I think we'll want to scale that to thousands more people who will be tremendously impactful in domains outside of, you know, company entrepreneurship. Because I think the largest enemy that we're fighting that with Pioneer is this kind of subtle enemy of self-editing. It's that people who are really great, not quite sure if they should do that idea that they had in the shower, you know? And for listening to this podcast, you should. Basically, that's the main message of Pioneer is we're not telling people what to do. In fact, you have to have a project to apply. We're not giving people startup ideas. We're not incubating things. We're just telling people to chase their own dreams. And so 5 years from now, if we have something that feels like, you know, Fortnite in terms of the amount of activity on it, but instead of uselessly playing a game, these people are being productive in their own domain, I think we'll feel like we're on our way to making a dent in the world.
Laura, you mentioned part of your, I guess, trajectory in your career was based on getting a response from an email. And it's feels like sometimes people just need, it's like a tipping point. It's like one thing that leads to a series of things. And
Well, I mean, I think the other funny thing, and I think I only told Dagny this kind of like really recently, but because I only realized it recently, was when I was considering the decision to start the fund and leave an academic career at MIT, which is a really, it's probably the biggest decision I made in my life. One of the things that I read was an article about his journey, sort of going from Israel to YC and the decision that he made there. And I think reading about somebody else and just having inspiration of like knowing that you could do this was almost the trick to not self-edit out of that journey. And so it's amazing that now like he's scaling this, because I think it's actually like that I've personally experienced how much that decision can mean. And I think it's so important that, you know, the next 100 people who think about that same decision, you know that they can actually make the leap and things are going to work out just fine.
Mm-hmm. Role models are so important. If you don't have a role model or someone that you can identify with, it's like hard to see the future, what you could become.
Who convinced you, who gave you the permission to start Product Hunt?
Good question. I don't think anyone gave me the permission per se. And the path to Product Hunt was very organic for me in that I love technology. I love products. I love conversations like this. And I had over time in Silicon Valley built some relationships with some people, which was sort of the base of the community. And without that base and that foundation, it would have been, if I tried to start Product Hunt 3 years prior when I didn't have as much of a network or experience, I wouldn't have gone anywhere because I didn't have that kind of that tipping point. Going back to what I said before, like I had just enough people that listened to my tweets and my blog posts to get them to convert and like participate, that it then snowballed into what it's become today. But without that, it just, in isolation, it wouldn't have gone anywhere.
What is your advice today? I'm sure you get a lot of emails from kind of young Ryan Hoovers trying to figure out what their first step would be. What's the advice you give them?
So, yeah, I think it depends on what you want to do and what you want to become, of course. However, I think a lot of people are very hesitant to share their ideas or actually take a leap and build a side project. And some people overthink it. They think they need to, on the extreme side, write a business plan and figure everything out. And at the end of the day, you can actually spend a weekend to make progress. Product Hunt was a 30-minute MVP. Like, it was an email list. It took no time at all. It just took some motivation and some like excitement of my own. And so I think some people just overthink it. And furthermore, I think the other thing that people don't think about a lot of times is if you're trying to build a successful business or a product that people use, they don't oftentimes think about the distribution or marketing challenge. And that's like the hardest part oftentimes. Like, you can build an awesome product, but how do people discover it? And so one strategy is to start early on, even before you know what you want to build, start building relationships with people, start building an audience, not for vanity metrics, but an audience gives you access to people to collaborate with, to recruit, to gather feedback from, and then to launch to or to acquire in the future. And that can run in the form of doing a podcast or writing blog posts or hosting meetups. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do that.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it definitely speaks to one mistake I see people make that's quite common is people think of company they want to start instead of project they want to work on. And the word company is not on Pioneer's homepage. It's all about projects. Because I think the thing people forget is that like big things like Product Hunt start out really small, like an email list.
We called it an experiment for several months. And the reason why I use that phrasing is because it, one, gave me permission to fail to some extent, to tinker. And it also put low pressure for everyone else. When you say, oh, I'm launching a company, many of them are like, they actually have more hesitation and they're less willing to accept your janky MVP. But if you say experiment, it's like, okay, the whole goal is to learn, and the learning then will hopefully translate into a project and then a company and so on. Yeah, I'm excited to see what comes with Pioneer, especially with this first like, is it batch or how are you kind of like segmenting the different cohorts?
So our goal is to run the process I mentioned earlier, the Pioneer Tournament, every 30 days. And that's going to be hard. That's never been done before. The scale that we're going to try to operate at has never been done before, but we'll try. Yeah, and so we're going to have later this month, we'll have some interesting results from the first tournament.
So before we wrap up, are there any plugs you want to give, Laura, to portfolio companies or anything? You know, if some company or young person out there is, you know, curious about science or anything like that, anything you want to say to them?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think if they're 12, they should apply to Pioneer. But I think we also have an age one accelerator where we're helping grad students and postdocs and people that are scientists start companies. And so we're offering kind of $500,000 to kind of help, you know, see them in that journey and a lot of help and support. So just anybody who, and honestly, you know, we're seeing kind of just like a massive amount of like sort of funding in biotech that's super excited to come into new companies. And so folks who would like to pursue that, you know, please definitely reach out to Laura at longevity.vc.
What about you, Daniel?
Well, I guess my plug would be to people who are listening here, because I think there's three people in a room here who got tremendous amount of success in very untraditional ways. And I think that the wonderful thing about the world today is that with the internet, you can bypass the traditional hierarchies in order to be successful. I think it used to, like, I think all of us would have been very unhappy 300-400 years ago, where you had to do a lot of traditional stuff before you could get anywhere. You can totally sidestep all of that if you're curious and creative and inventive. And Pioneer is one of many ways you could potentially highlight yourself to drastically kind of get ahead of the game. And I think the only thing you have to do, you don't even have to apply to Pioneer if you don't want to. The thing you really have to do, if you want to become a Laura Deming or a Ryan Hoover, it seems like you just have to take your passion seriously. And no one, to your point about Product Hunt, no one needs to give you permission.
My brother, he's about 4 years younger than me, and he was working in jobs that he just didn't like. You know, he worked at UPS night shift for a long time, for 3 years. Yet he started to gravitate towards filmography, like videoing his trips with his dog, his hikes with his dog, and then he got into editing these videos and creating like these really beautiful like music videos, essentially. And his first videos were not good, of course. Like, he just started. But over the course of about 2.5 years, he got really, really good. And thank God he eventually turned that into his career, which he is now a videographer and travels around. He was going to go to Hawaii until they had some storms to film and then, you know, create essentially stock video for this company. And he loves what he's doing. He's like found his passion. And I hope more people can find their passion and then hopefully turn that passion into their career. Because I was tweeting with someone earlier today. It's like, if you, and this is a riff off someone else's quote, but like, if you love what you're doing, you'll never work ever a day in your life. And yeah, I think a lot of people, unfortunately, just don't get to find that.
And I think the key is, do not treat anything like a kind of infinite adventure. You have to decide your life's passion now. You have to decide your life's work. Everything is like, you know, these are kind of feedback loops that you step into, and they seem really small and dumb. You know, it seems like sending an email to someone when you're 12, or it seems like starting an email list that turns into leadership position at AngelList. And so I'd encourage people to not really think big picture and to just take that small idea they had in the shower a little bit further.
Yeah. Experiment.
Experiment.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming over. This is a fun chat.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you bet. Talk soon. Now's the part of the show where we hear from you, the listeners. We asked the Product Hunt community, what's your favorite home screen app that few people know about? Here are a few of the responses.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Hey, what's up, Ryan? My favorite app right now is TikTok, formerly known as Musical.ly, and it is the beloved Vine. If Vine didn't die, so it's everything that Vine was, but a progression of it. All the content is pure and unique, so everything that's being made is completely custom content. I just like that it's like a breeding ground of that unique and custom content. My name's Steven here in San Francisco.
If you'd like to share your favorite apps on the show, give us a call at 707-785-6152. Stay tuned for my talk with Ashish Jain from Avitas Systems, a startup using drones and AI to inspect industrial assets like oil refineries and power lines. Thanks for joining us, Ashish, and thanks to GE Ventures for making this interview possible. How are people doing this without this technology?
Let's imagine you look at a particular industrial complex. Imagine you have to inspect that. First, you have to shut down that facility because it's hazardous for somebody to climb up there using ropes or ladders and collect the data. Second problem is that it's a very manual task, and the skill and the expertise level of people vary. So there is a tremendous quality issue. There's a prime example where you could actually send an industrial drone to collect the data.
And what can you do with more consistent data collection?
If I collect data precisely and the quality of collection goes up, my analysis goes up, my outcome goes up, And the beauty of all this is that it's completely repeatable and it can be automated, and you can really remove the human element out of the dangerous, dirty area. And then we have advanced AI, really industrial AI, which interprets the data. And then finally, what we do is we basically provide outcomes in terms of intelligent planning tools, decision support systems to our customers. Right now, this particular space is fairly early stage of digitalization. From our perspective, it's a tremendous opportunity.
Thanks again, GE Ventures, for making this interview possible. GE Ventures invests in startups that develop transformational technologies to solve big problems. Visit ge.com/ventures to learn more.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.